great leaders from the past, but these leaders who are with us. And having been enriched already this morning in the service of worship and the preceding lecture, we look forward to another now, the second of the James A. Gray lectures with Dr. Albert C. Outler, who, as some heard yesterday, came to this faculty 45 years ago. And then he left for a while, but he's come back to try to make up for some of that. He is speaking today on adventures and misadventures in American Methodism. And I'm currently engaged in proofreading the first volume of Wesley's sermons as introduced and annotated richly by Albert Outler. It's fascinating. His footnote this morning will be too.
We've already had not only brilliant exposition of Luther and his ambivalences adding up to a plus, and a Lutheran message from the divine, it put me in mind of the story they tell in Rome about the Benedictine and the Franciscan and the Dominican and the Jesuit arguing about which order God loves the best and favors most. And since they were there in St. Peter's, and there is the Confessio out there, they decided actually at the behest of the Benedictines to have a little session of prayer. And so they knelt at the Confessio Petri and prayed for the answer to which order God preferred most. And when they got through the prayer, they noticed that a little note had fluttered down out of the Bernini Baldacchino onto the altar, and it said, "I love all my children equally, signed God, S.J." There, it is a rare privilege to follow Marty. Marty, after he had suggested that American Methodism must be Wesleyan, because that isn't quite so, and the chance to explain how it isn't quite so is doesn't come often in my life. And here we go. Summer after summer, American Methodists flocked to England on pious pilgrimage to Wesley shrines. They are normally a cheerful lot, and their mien and manners are more serious and sedate than those rowdies of Chaucer at the Tabard End in Southwark. They thrill to walk where Wesley walked, to look in on his rooms in Lincoln College, wrong rooms, but who cares about that except a few nitpickers? And it is well known that Methodists prefer nits to their nitpickers. They are uplifted when they stand in the pulpit of South Lee, where the plaque says Wesley preached his first sermon. Wrong church, wrong sermon, but still an elevating experience. And And then there's always the parsonage at Epworth and the chapel at City Road, of which Jack Bomo once said it was like an axe that had already two handles and one extra head. Otherwise, it was still the same axe. And they are grateful to their British hosts, who are so heroically hospitable, but also, well, different. Now, what this hero worship reflects in part is the popular assumption on our part that American Methodism was a direct transatlantic transplantation of Wesley's Methodism and a linear development from it, with a few circumstantial differences that are easily accounted for. But this assumption is misleading, as one can see at any of the various World Methodist affairs where Methodists from all over the world speak as one of Wesley as founder, and then go on to differ about almost everything else under heaven. Now, there's more here than the inevitable mutations in our different national histories, as important as such things are. In British Methodism, as I have seen it over the years, the ghostly presence of Mr. Wesley still persists, albeit more and more nebulously in later years, and that is an ill omen for their future. His persona lives on in the conference. The conference is Wesley's persona persisting in space and time, and archetypically in the conference president for the time he is president. Now, in American Methodism, Wesley's role has been rather more eponymous than personal. He's been revered as our Father in God. His authority has regularly been proof-texted in many good cause and many cause not so good. He has not been studied in depth and in detail. His substantive influence was subverted from the beginning. None of the American Methodists from Robert Strawbridge, if you really count him as a Methodist, as Wesley would not have, and to Barbara Heck, to Francis Asbury, none of them had Wesley's Anglican background, and none had more than a tenuous linkage with Wesley himself as their spiritual director or theological tutor. By 1778, all of Wesley's appointed missionaries to America had absconded, except for Asbury, who simply ignored his patriarch's directive, as he would again whenever it suited him. The strange events of 1784 on both sides of the Atlantic were precipitated less by broad-gauged ecclesiological considerations or any deep reflection on the question of a religious society becoming a church than it was by a series of practical exigencies. For example, Fletcher's death and the Fluvanna Schism, and in America, the fresh impulses in a new nation. I have long since despaired of any real clarity about the events of September 2nd, 1784 in Bristol. I know what is said to have happened, but I do not understand it, and not for want of trying either. Now, this is not the time or occasion to attempt at unraveling what is at best an ecclesiological anomaly that affects Methodist orders in a fashion that I wouldn't want to speak too loudly in front of Episcopalians or Roman Catholics, so I can tell you the Catholics understand it a great deal better than the Episcopalians. But then the Episcopalians have always had a thing about Methodists, and Methodists have always had a worse thing about Episcopalians. At the very least, however, Wesley was a self-avowed scriptural episcopos, which is not the same thing as an episcopos in apostolic succession. And he was trying to provide sacraments for the Methodists in America under circumstances from which there was no alternative. And Dr. Marty was speaking of the importance historiographically of asking what under the circumstances were the options that people had. He was also trying to reestablish his own connection with them as their chief spiritual director, as he was of British Methodists, and to set them on their feet in their new circumstances. This is abundantly evident in the famous letter to our brethren in America that I presume all of you who are Methodists have read, and all who are not Methodists should have heard about from the Methodist friends you have. And if you have some Methodist friends, ask them about our Wesley's letter to our brethren in America. If they say what, you press the point real hard. Nobody followed Wesley's scenario. Dr. Cook had his own ideas about his peculiar role as a core episcopos, which included the liberty of further revising Wesley's revision of the Book of Common Prayer. It was almost certainly his idea to have a new church, to have it denominated Episcopal, and to have its general superintendence, which was Wesley's title, take the label bishop. Actually, however, it was Francis Asbury who called the shots and who gave the new church its distinctive polity and character. The Christmas conference was one of those marvels of improvisation in which almost everything was equally irregular and truly momentous. It came at a fullness of time. It launched a new church in a new nation with a polity defined by its mission and, in Charles Ferguson's apt phrase, organized to beat the devil. And the point here is that American Methodism, in its bonding time, was more Asburian than Wesleyan, and that Asbury was no clone of Wesley by any means, except in their shared concern to spread scriptural holiness over these lands. Mr. Wesley conceived of American Methodism as still a further branch of the Methodist family, and you can see this in the wistful tone of his last letter to America. See that you never give place to one thought of separating from your brethren in Europe, he wrote to Ezekiel Cooper a month before he died. Lose no opportunity of declaring to all men that the Methodists are one people in all the world and that it is their full determination to continue. Brave words, still repeated, not quite true in the beginning, not as true now. History, you see, had already outrun any such hope. Wesley had nominated Richard Whatcoat for election as general superintendent. The Americans had balked. Wesley had deplored Asbury's use of the title bishop. Asbury had shrugged him off, along with some patronizing comments about dear old daddy. Wesley had long since concluded on ecclesiological grounds that elders and bishops were of the same sacramental order. Asbury had concluded on merely functional grounds that his own supreme authority in the MEC amounted to a third order. Therefore, the third order was both biblically and empirically a sound polity. American Methodist historians have not been quite candid about the estrangements between Asbury and Wesley. They were candid enough about it, and I don't know why we can't be now. I was a little surprised, wrote Wesley to an American friend in 1789, when I received some letters from Mr. Asbury affirming that no person in Europe knew how to direct those in America. Soon after, he flatly refused to receive Mr. Whatcoat in the character I sent him. He told George Shadford, Mr. Wesley and I are like Caesar and Pompey. He will bear no equal, and I will bear no superior. Accordingly, he quietly sat by until his friends voted my name out of the American minutes. This completed the matter and showed that he had no connection with me. Later, Wesley's name was reinstated on an honorary basis in the minutes, but the breach was never healed. Asbury was left without rival or mentor, free to ignore Cook except for ceremonial occasions, like when they would go to New York, see President Washington. That's an old Methodist tradition. Free to let the Sunday service slip into oblivion, free to alter the constitutional status of the Articles of Religion, free to drive James O'Kelly into undeserved exile, yet also free to lead American Methodism from strength to strength for a full quarter century. Nothing succeeds like success, and nothing vindicated Asbury's idea of polity, that is to say, a monarchical episcopacy, the appointive system, the itinerancy, presiding elders as the bishop's bailiffs, etc., etc., like their effectiveness in mission. There were other notable Methodists, of course, Freeborn Garretson, Nathan Bangs, John Emory, Stephen Olin, and others. There was the noble army of circuit riders who redefined Christian martyrdom on the American frontier. But the distinctive ethos of American Methodism was molded more by Francis Asbury than by any other person. In the church, he left behind both his virtues and his faults, and they have been intinctured in the very fabric of American Methodism. Understanding Asbury is a precondition to understanding American Methodism, and that is a pity, because as of now, we have no adequate resources for understanding Asbury. No adequate edition of his works, and the biographies and analysis that we have are less probing and more eulogistic than do any real good at understanding. This is to imply, and I do it quite consciously, that American Methodists have had a deficient self-understanding from the beginning. Asbury's flaws can be seen as character traits in subsequent Methodist history. A pious lust for power, for God's glory, of course. What else? A bent to theological reductionism and anti-intellectualism. A sacramental minimalism. His standard term for the sacraments is ordinances. A violent antipathy toward other churches, Episcopalians most of all, but Baptists and all the others. His passionate faith in numbers as proving God's providence. His blend of triumphalism and self-pity. These are character traits in American Methodism. I'm sorry there are Lutherans listening in. Now, it has been said of Andrew Greeley that he has never had an unpublished thought or fantasy. So also it could be said of Francis Asbury that he had no unrecorded ailments. If only the people knew of my sufferings, he could write, and associate that with a reference to my martyrdom. He opined to Thomas Haskins when a man is in his 62nd year, it is not safe to trust a great work into his trembling hands. But he survived a full decade longer than that and never relinquished one whit of his unchallenged control. His triumphalism was so ingrained that it was quite unselfconscious. "You cannot conceive what God has done for America," he writes, "compared with the British connection begun in England in 1730, sick. It now numbers 150,974. I told you his passion for numbers went right down to the digit. And this is out of 31 or 2 million souls, which stretches the figure on the upside for the population of Britain in 1730. Methodism began in America in 1771, which is not the way the books have it, at 1766. But it was when Asbury landed in America. Methodism began in America in 1771. It numbers now 144,590. It stretches over 2,500 miles and a population of 3 to 5 million souls scattered abroad. In England, men of great learning, advantage of books. In America, unlearned, poor men, woods boys, like in the Duke Forest. And we shall see greater times. Stand to the lance, death or victory, and victory is death. Glory, glory, glory. In a letter to Nelson Reed, Daniel Hitt recalls a double question that Asbury was fond of framing. What church in any modern century has prospered in number and genuine piety equal to the Methodist Episcopal Church? If we have been thus prosperous and successful, and this is the second question, why should we depart from our present economy and regulations? Tomorrow we may also ask the same question again, but with the same logic and a different premise. If we are not thus prosperous and successful now, why not depart from our present economy and regulations? And yet it was this man, with an evangelical militia at his command, who led the Methodist in America from a nearly standing start when he arrived in Philadelphia, October 27, 1771, to the status of being the largest and liveliest denomination in America when he died near Richmond, March 31, 1816. It was an exciting and significant four-decade span. Another Reformation in the Wesleyan spirit. It was, moreover, a success story that cannot be dismissed as merely superficial. To begin with, there was the Mortist fit of Asbury's profession and performance. If he wore the label bishop, which he came finally to regret, and that's not normally recorded in the books, he wore no lawn sleeves and tolerated no pomp or circumstance. Fiercely jealous of his power to appoint the preachers, he had almost no other ambitions and none of the usual self-indulgences. He was, as he said of himself, a bishop and a beggar. And for this, plain people in the cities and towns and frontiers and frontier clearings received him as one of their very own. He scorned both preachers and churches that had settled on their lees, one of his favorite quotations from Jeremiah and Zechariah. His own dedication to poverty, chastity, and obedience was patent. His fortitude and drivenness, his passion for souls and his special compassion for Christ's poor made of him a special sort of martyr. For all his hypochondria, which stirs a fellow feeling in me too, he was a true reformer in the classical sense. On the psychological side, there was his zeal, his self-abnegation, his Christian fortitude, his kindliness, his monomania in mission, to use the phrase of Tom Peters and Bob Waterman. On the theological side, there was his total devotedness to Christ, his self-taught at-homeness in the Scriptures, his rousing gospel message, oversimplified but authentic, repentance, faith, and holiness. There was his balanced stress on conversion and nurture, his conception of the laity as the church visible, the church visible and the church local, ordained to works of love and mercy. The theme of growing into God is axial in his doctrine of perfection, and his piety was as refreshed and refreshing in his old age as when younger. Reform for Asbury grew out of order, discipline, and fruitfulness in mission. Proclamation and polity stood intertwined in his concept of mission, as it had for Wesley and as it has in authentic Methodism ever since. The axis of Methodist polity for Asbury was the itinerancy. In no other denomination were the preachers so mobile, so adaptable, and so short-lived as in early American Methodism. And the nexus of the whole was connectionalism, which is to say the conference system and its networks. His authoritarianism was mitigated by his total involvement. He led more by example than directive, and it was an example that could be followed by committed men and women with no more formal training and culture than could be had from their iron rations of the Bible, the hymnal, and the discipline. The MEC had no headquarters, no curia, a simply unimaginable state of affairs. Given its conference system, it could and did rely on grassroots leadership and lay initiatives. Now, we have spoken much of Asbury and only hinted at other Methodist notables. But the Methodist adventure in the 19th century was actually carried forward by its rank and file, and this has been the case then and since. By and large, it was a fellowship of ordinary people inspired to extraordinary efforts and effects. The system worked from below upward and back down again, which helps to explain how a monarchical episcopacy and a participatory democracy could work together in real synergism. The Methodists did not start the Second Great Awakening, but they were deeply involved in it. They did not invent revivals or camp meetings, but they adapted them to great advantage. What they did invent was the circuit rider. Gospel pioneers under marching orders who could range the towns and the wilderness with marvelous flexibility. Each was an evangelist in his own right, but each was linked in a fellowship that began with his nearest neighbor and stretched as far as the national borders and beyond into Canada and the Caribbean. Their aim was ubiquity, and they nearly got it. Their dread was becoming a rope of sand, a favorite phrase in Wesley, and Asbury picked it up and used it repeatedly. And there's a long footnote about where it came from in the sermons you've never seen and may never. Now, it was connectionalism without a curia, mind you, that kept the revival going and that rekindled the flames of the Spirit whenever they flickered low. It looked like a closed system, and it was in many ways, but it allowed for more spontaneity and initiative than any of the others, and it gave the Methodist preacher more freedom in the pulpit than any congregational system ever did. Time would fail us to tell of the adventures of 19th century Methodism in the making of America, of the filling up of the empty spaces, the fulfilling of various hopes and dreams engendered by the frontier. This is, however, just as well, because this part of the story is what all good Methodists, and most Americans for that matter, already know well. It has been told and retold lovingly by Methodist historians from Jesse Lee to Abel Stevens to Charles Ferguson and Frederick Norwood. It is the story of the spreading influence of an oversimplified version of Wesleyan soteriology, a pre-critical biblicism, a stress on the Methodist essentials, original sin, prevenient grace, repentance, justification by faith, regeneration, sanctification, and their translation into changed persons who then went on to change society. What I want to concentrate on are a few less familiar aspects of the story that are, I hope, equally edifying, if only by their prodding of our Methodist consciences and the aid of non-Methodists in having something to talk to us about that would prod our conscience. First, there was the growth rate. Now, church statistics are notoriously unreliable, and quantity does not translate into quality. But these statistics are rough pointer readings, and besides, Methodists had probationary tests for members till late in the 19th century, and that tended to keep their polls more honest than they are now. In 1780, there were 8,500 Methodists on the society rolls, and half of them in Maryland. A decade later, there were 57,000 from Maine to South Carolina in a reduced overall population. The curve then flattens a bit, but continues steadily upward, surpassing the Baptists in 1820, as it should. Tomorrow we'll discover when the reverse took place. Surpassing the Baptists in 1820 and matching and surpassing the natural population curve for the rest of the century. It is true, of course, that almost all the denominations were flourishing in the 19th century, but the Methodists were like Abub and Adam in the vanguard. As the West was opened up, there was the familiar race between the pioneers, the saloon keepers, and the circuit riders, and the saloon keepers didn't always win. Meanwhile, the Methodists held their Atlantic seaboard base and came as close as they could to being all things to all persons in their zeal for saving some, as many as possible. But there was this sad susceptibility in Methodism to schism, almost always on issues less creditable than a clear conscience as to doctrine. Part of this came from the strong sectarian impulses latent in a church or churches that had so lately been a religious society, merely a voluntary association, if you can use merely in that context. The first schism, James O'Kelly's futile protest against Asbury's high-handedness, came less than 10 years after the Christmas conference, and we ought to have a bicentennial for that. And this left the issue of episcopal authority unresolved in principle, as it has continued to be to this day. The second rupture came from white insensitivity to black sensibilities, with consequences that still plague us all. This was followed by a most unedifying struggle over clerical privilege, and the result was the Methodist Protestant Church, and so on and on until we can count 28 American denominations with Methodists in their titles, plus a dozen others rooted in the Wesleyan heritage. Have you got any well-considered, credible answer to this strange question, why are Methodists so brittle? The most massive and tragic of the schisms was, of course, in 1844. It was over slavery, and yet also over the status of the episcopal office. And those who would have it either way cannot, because it was in fact both ways. The lasting bitterness engendered by this tragedy was compounded by the fact that while the other spinoffs from the MEC had only managed to survive in a maintenance mode, the Methodist Episcopal Church South, despite its wholly indefensible stand on slavery, despite the CME secession, despite the horrors of Reconstruction, went on to quadruple in size, while the Methodist Episcopal Church was merely trebling, thus rendering the appeal to the logic of pragmatism ambiguous, to say the least. In the process, the main point of the Methodist reformers of the 1820s, namely lay representation, had been taken up into Episcopal Methodism, but without any effective impulse toward reunion with the Methodist Protestant Church until way late, actually in the 20th century. Now, in 1866, there was a bicentennial of sorts. In recognition of the fact that Methodism began in America sometime in 1866 and maybe in Maryland and maybe in New York and maybe in 1766. Now, all of this was summed up in typical fashion by C.C. Goss in his Statistical History of the First Century of American Methodism. Methodism's great success, he said at the time, successes are attributed to eight distinctive Methodist traits. One, enthusiastic preaching. Two, a self-sacrificing spirit in the ministry. Three, a special emphasis on a free church in a free state. Four, frequent revivals. Five, lay witness. Six, missionary outreach. Seven, stress on heart religion. Eight, the doctrine and experience of sanctification. Schismatic Methodists found a way to transcend their fragmentation symbolically with a series of ecumenical conferences beginning in 1871, in which they could celebrate their shared Wesleyan heritage with no serious challenges to the ecclesiastical status quo. They could have fun and no harm done. These amiable experiences added to the general eagerness for a proper centennial in 1884. This eagerness was enhanced by four other significant developments of diverse sorts. The first was a tentative move toward reconciliation between the MEC and the MECS in the Cape May Declaration of 1876, about which I presume you would already know. These proposals there projected were wildly unrealistic. The two churches mistrusted each other more deeply than the commissioners realized, but their agreement on a shared heritage added to their enthusiasm for joint celebration of their past, so long as their futures were not put in risk. Now, a second impetus came from American Methodists' belated encounter with the Enlightenment. It didn't get to us, generally speaking, till after the Civil War, and didn't get to us close until in the 1880s. German idealism, historical literary criticism, Darwinism, liberalism, all those isms. Now, despite all the furores thus generated, the Methodist intellectuals, that tiny, gallant minority for whom there has never been a proper caucus, the Methodist intellectuals were confident that all of these challenges could be accommodated to the glory of God and of Methodism, which is something of a redundancy. Now, the point is that in 1884, nearly everybody had something very special to celebrate. A third development was Methodism's comparatively effective adaptation to most of the drastic social and economic changes in a country in the throes of urbanization, industrialization, bourgeoisization. In less than three decades, Methodism shifted from a largely agrarian to a predominantly bourgeois church. More support for Methodist colleges, universities, and seminaries became available. The cause of foreign missions began to flourish. And all of this was proof of God's favor, which is to say, still further cause for celebration, fresh hopes for a bright future. A fourth development that lifted Methodism's expectations was her positive reaction to the social gospel, then in its early stages. The Methodist phrase for it in most of the literature of the time in those days was our mission to the extremes of society. End of quote. This came in part from Methodism's original passion for economic and social justice and for amelioration of the human circumstance. But there was also the exhilarating prospect of the salvation of souls as a byproduct of the salvation of society itself. And this seemed a more efficient way of getting the job done. And we've always been on the search for more efficient ways of getting the job done, even though they aren't more efficient, they look more efficient and can be reported as if they were. Now, it is a pity, in my view, that the drama of the centennial celebration of 1884 has been allowed to drop out of our list of landmark events. It was not included in the stereotypical history with which I grew up, and it has been left untold by our historians. But when I went back to the primary sources, I was impressed, not least of all because there's no conceivable prospect of this sort of thing being repeated in 1984. Preparations for it spanned a decade. It was a nationwide concern, and its climax in Baltimore spread over an entire incredible week, with 25,000 Sunday school children in a glittering parade, with representatives from eight Methodist denominations joining in, and with ripplings that lasted out the century. It is difficult to credit the unqualified, soaring optimism of those days, the solemn baptism of the doctrine of progress as if it were a religious dogma and as if Methodism was its prime exemplar. It may be worth offering you some samplings from the official proceedings of that centennial, partly because of their intrinsic interest and partly because we need to understand their mood 100 years ago if we are to compare it with ours on the threshold of our bicentennial. There was, at the very outset, an assurance from Dr. J.B. McFerrin of Methodism's doctrinal stability. McFerrin was an anomaly in all sorts of ways. He was a Southerner, he was highly educated for the times, and therefore accounted as a liberal. Mr. Chairman, we have not come here to legislate or to make suggestions with regards to new creeds. Some say it is time for the creeds of the churches to be remodeled. Well, that may do for some people's creeds, but not ours. Our creed is like the New Testament, finished. Woe be to the man who takes anything out of it or puts anything into it. Justification by faith, the witness of the Spirit, sanctification of heart and life, these are the grand peculiarities of Methodism. Let them be preserved forever. Can you imagine a setting anywhere in contemporary Methodism in which such a blast would be appropriate? But then, if that is so, how did we get from there to here? Methodist triumphalism was then summed up by Professor J.C. Price. And if these are obscure names, that ought to tell you something. The spirit of Methodism must and will go on until all around this country there shall be a cordon of lights from the Atlantic to the Golden Gate, from the north to the Gulf, until the campfires of Methodism shall light the entire country. When in all of the islands of the sea and all the countries of the earth, they shall know the power of the gospel as spread by Methodism. The next 100 years they shall know more, and the next 100 years after that, they shall know more still. Can you imagine the embarrassed silence following such arousement next year in Baltimore? The most notable utterance of the week came from Bishop Randolph Foster, a former theological professor who was also an admirer of Phoebe Palmer. I mentioned those two in order to establish a paradox, not relief. He was also favorably disposed toward the New Holiness Association before it got as disruptive as it was. You see, the two scheduled keynoters of the conference were to have been Bishops Matthew Simpson and George Foster Pierce, the senior paladins, respectively, of the MEC and the MECS. Both had been born in the same year, elected bishops at their same respective general conferences, and both had recently died within the same fortnight. Bishop Foster had been rushed into the breach and, as the minutes faithfully recalled, held the unwearied attention of the conference for more than 2 hours. That, too, is a difference between then and now. Moreover, he mirrored the Methodist mind of those days as faithfully as makes no matter. His first main point was about Methodism as a moral force. "'Tis we who have taught humanity to know its rights, who have gone forth snapping chains of superstition, disenthralling minds, casting down thrones and dynasties, overturning customs and temples and religions. We have taught man the art of inquiry, the right of doubt, the duty of revolution. The storm we now behold raging over the world is but the going forth of liberated thought, the conflict and struggle of ideas. And the more lies upon our foundations, what shall we do? Shades of Yeats' second coming, 40 years ahead of time. The bishop's confidence that Methodism will not only weather the storm, but also rise to the new challenges is given voice as splendidly as it had done in times past. It will not do, says he, to canonize ignorance or anti-intellectualism. The Christian creed is the truth. It must be so proclaimed and so defended. But it is the pulpit, he went on to emphasize, that is the focal point of the church's life. And it is currently in trouble, in 1884 that was, because he could speak of its insipidities and platitudes. If, standing at the doors of our second century, it might be so laid upon our hearts that the pulpit of Methodism must be roused to its ancient zeal, its ancient hunger for souls, its ancient heroism, it would send a thrill of joy through 1,000 discouraged, starving churches and a quickened life that would stir the land from rim to rim. But the pulpit is above politics. The church was not designed for theocratic rule in the secular order. Even so, she is ordained to function as the moral leader of the race. Where there is wrong, she is bound to condemn it. Where there is right, she is bound to identify and with and support it wholly, irrespective of persons or parties. Then he has a litany of denunciations of intoxicants and drugs. He speaks of it as the monstrum horrendum of Christian civilization. And then he speaks of economic and social injustices, the church's neglect of the masses, and on and on. And his peroration has echoes of a Richelian eschatology ratcheted up to a pitch that Richel could scarcely have imagined. He was, after all, a fairly stodgy old man. The church, says Foster, is the kingdom of God among men. She will outlive all her defects and will yet lift the world into the light. In the providence of God, we are in the focus of the conflict. On this continent, more than anywhere else, the final battle is raging. It will not be brief. We shall not see its end, but there can be no doubt of its outcome. Methodists of America, behold the field, behold the enemy. Dropping all feuds, be valiant. Quit you now like men. Hasten the coming age. Let there be no laggards in our camps. Press the battle. Let it be known to all that where your colors fly, there is courage, loyalty, victory. We still have rhetoric like that in secondhand car advertising. In inspirational speeches of Zig Ziglar, and in the scientific homilies of Carl Sagan. But rarely in our churches. There are reasons for this, good and bad, and we shall return to them tomorrow. For now, it is enough to stress that the Methodists of that century one, stretching from the Christmas Conference through the centenary of 1919, which was the 100th anniversary of the Missionary Society, that they had much to celebrate, or thought they had. There was a freshness and hopefulness in their mission and ministry that made their difficulties bearable with joy. And this is anapausis updated to the last part of the 19th century. And the consequence was that for all its flaws and misadventures, despite all myopias and failed opportunities, American Methodism in all its fragments had a very long stretch of spiritual invigoration, anakinesis. What is more, it had wrought wonders, including a partial recovery from a civil war that was so savage and tragic that its moral taints have not yet been wiped away from our national soul and may never be. In this epoch, almost everything was new, whatever its earlier sources. We still continue this tradition in an uncomprehended way whenever we pass a familiar dollar bill. And Dr. Marty referred to that. He didn't mention that seclorum is a misspelling that we dast not change on the currency. The future was open. The labor union songs were as confident as the new missionary hymns and vice versa. Actually, they came out of the same genre. We shall overcome has a longer, richer history than its recent role in our civil rights struggles. American Methodism had a natural advantage during such a period with its stress on conversion, assurance, growth, refreshments of the spirit, and its harvest in good works. Its doctrine of perfection in love as a process found a resonance with the Enlightenment doctrine of perfectibility as an intrinsic human possibility. And the radical distinction between the two perspectives came to be blurred. This pushed the holiness people further away from the Enlightenment and its goals, even as it also nudged the liberals further toward an American Methodist Pelagianism. At any rate, American Methodism was committed to the idea of reform, either in its classical sense or in its secular versions of progress and perfectibility, sometimes an odd mixture of both. It was alert and eager in its accommodation to the brave new world then aborning. Hermann Lotze's German idealism seemed a credible updating for Wesley's Christian Platonism. Personalism was taken as an adequate revision of Wesley's anthropology. The global triumphs of Western civilization seemed a natural counterpart to the triumphs of grace. And again, vice versa. The new sciences and technology and seemed reliable resources for the Christian amelioration of the human condition, and hence partners with religion. The social creed of 1908 comes from this, so also the Hymns for the New Age, so also Daniel Dorchester's The Problem of Religious Progress, so also such good causes as woman's suffrage, the goodwill industries, the cause of war and peace. Never mind Jim Crow, never mind the Pullman strike, never mind rural peonage, never mind the urban slums and Thorstein Veblen's indictment of the bourgeoisie, American as well as European, and it fits Methodism to a T. No, Daniel Dorchester spoke for many when he dismissed such problems as an ugly clutter from a passing age. No intelligent being, said he, with typical Methodist understatement, can deny that Protestant Christianity is a rising, not a setting sun. Each year it is robing itself in fuller effulgence and pouring its blessed illuminations upon new millions of earth's benighted children. Such a prospect, and I remember it from my childhood, never seemed more assured than when the guns of August 1914 boomed out its knell. Even then, most of us took that tolling as a passing bell, an intermission after which we could resume our adventures of bringing in the kingdom. It's been a long intermission with no resumption in sight. And now a bicentennial has come upon us, whether we are ready or not. I would be grateful, however, as we face this bicentennial together in tomorrow's lecture, you would not expect too many eschatological rabbits out of our present battered ecclesiastical hat.
Thank you for another very illuminating presentation. You'll be here tomorrow. Presently, those who have tickets for the convocation luncheon will go to the lower floor of this building, to the Von Cannon dining halls for that luncheon. At 2:00, we reconvene here for a panel for a symposium in which three of our former Gray lecturers, one of them who's here in second incarnation, and other distinguished United Methodist leaders will reflect upon where we are and where we're going. And Albert Outler will be among them, probably to add some footnotes that disturb us. We are adjourned.
Thank you, that was great. That was great. Searching, disturbing.